The best way to manage low back pain.
The risk to the baby when the mother has gestational diabetes.
Keeping the scalp cool may help with hair loss when women have chemotherapy.
And does the way that physicians prescribe opioids contribute to the risk of long-term use?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on February 17th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start with this really enormous study, over 700,000 women in diabetologia. I always stumble over the name of that particular journal, taking a look at the risks relative to gestational diabetes.
There is actually a scant amount of data looking at the overall risk to newborns born to women that have gestational diabetes, particularly with regard to risk of having congenital malformations and respiratory issues. So these investigators looked at almost 800,000 deliveries in France in the year of 2012. And among these, by the way, there were almost 58,000 women that had gestational diabetes. So they're able to compare the outcomes for the baby for those mothers that had gestational diabetes and those that didn't. And what they discovered was that in the mothers that had gestational diabetes, the risk of preterm birth was increased by about 30%. The risk of needing a cesarean section increased by about 40%. The risk to the baby of having respiratory distress increased by 10%, birth trauma 30%, and cardiac malformations by 30% as well. Interestingly enough, there was no increase in the risk of having neurologic abnormalities.
Gestational diabetes, of course, is something that gets routinely tested for. So what is the public health implication for you then relative to the findings of this study?
We didn't talk about what the incidence is. In France, it's about 7%. In the United States, it's about 15%. We can lower that risk by doing some things before considering gestation, exercising, making sure that the mother's not overweight or obese. Obviously, we need to screen for it as well and treat it. Even having said that, though, these mothers were recognized, many of them on insulin, and it still increased the risk of having poor perinatal outcomes. And I just think we need to, first of all, recognize that and try to avoid having gestational diabetes in the first place, again, by the lifestyle measures we talked about.
Let's turn from here, then, to Annals of Internal Medicine. Very, very common problem. I would call it almost ubiquitous for everyone at some point in their lifetime, low back pain. How in the world should we manage this?
And Elizabeth, there are many different articles addressing several different aspects of back pain. So I'm going to try to summarize it in three recommendations to kind of summarize based upon an analysis of all the data. Their last report was in 2007, so these are updated studies. And recommendation number one is, given the fact that most patients that have acute or subacute back pain, that they improve over time regardless of treatment, superficial heat, there's moderate evidence that that can be beneficial. And there's other evidence, although not quite as good, that things like massage, acupuncture, or spinal manipulation can be beneficial. But we should avoid treating it with pharmacologic means. With regard to chronic back pain, it's recommended that clinicians and patients select non-pharmacologic treatment first. Things like exercise, acupuncture, multidisciplinary rehabilitation, mindfulness-based stress reduction. Less evidence for things like Tai Chi, yoga, biofeedback. But again, those should be tried first. Now, if those don't work, one can progress to pharmacology or using medications. Tylenol, really not beneficial. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications and duloxetine should be the primary ways of treating it. Systemic corticosteroids, not particularly beneficial. And opioids, really the very last method for treating back pain, and only after the physician has discussed the risk of using opioids, particularly with the use of long-term opioid use and or addiction.
And this devolves to me, of course, to the tincture of time for most cases of low back pain. Just kind of wait it out and see what you can do with regard to comfort measures. We've also seen a whole lot of evidence that says imaging is not terribly helpful in trying to assess it. Is that substantiated further in these guidelines?
Absolutely. So they recommend the routine use of imaging, unless there's a specific reason that's kind of out of the ordinary. Imaging isn't useful either. It's a waste of time and money, and it doesn't change the therapy either.
Well, this is also sounding like a pretty intensive conversation that's going to need to take place between providers and patients in order to get them to understand what's going on. Since we're talking about prescribing then, and the last thing that you mentioned was opioids, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a special study taking a look at prescribing patterns among ED emergency department physicians for opioids.
Many of our listeners may not be aware that opioid-related deaths have quadrupled in the United States over the past 3 decades. This epidemic has increasingly affected the elderly Medicare population, and that's because the elderly are really overly sensitive to the sedating properties and also to the respiratory depression properties as well. Well, the question is, how do people that are not already on opioids, how do they get introduced to them and end up using them long term? How often or to what extent does the prescribing practice of the physician contribute to that? These investigators did a retrospective analysis of Medicare beneficiaries who had an emergency room visit between 2008 and 2011. Now, these are people that had not received opioids in the previous 6 months. They looked at the physician's prescribing patterns and said, how often do they prescribe opioids? Now, some physicians prescribed them infrequently. About 7% of their patients got them. Some prescribed them for as much as a fourth of their patients. Those were considered high-intensity prescribers. When you followed the patients that saw the high-intensity prescribing physicians were more likely to be using opioids a year later, and it increased the risk by about 30%. And in fact, they said for every 49 patients, one would be on long-term opioid use as a result of the prescribing practice of the physician if they're one of the high-intensity prescribing practices.
That's a lot of people out there potentially addicted to opioid medications. However, I would also say that I have some concerns about this kind of scrutiny and the chilling effect it might have on the use of opioids in people who really need them.
When you take a step back, these patients, whether they were seen by the low or high intensity prescribers, were exactly the same. They had the same diagnosis. So what accounts for the threefold difference in opioid prescribing? Well, that's not a patient-driven factor. That's a physician-driven. It's easier to prescribe an opioid than it is to prescribe physical therapy sometimes, or to prescribe a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication. What I would say is that there are some patients that need them, but a threefold variation, we need to be scrutinizing that more carefully.
Well, I just have to share with you that another colleague here at Hopkins has recently published a personal essay relative to his own journey through opioid use subsequent to a lot of trauma surgery and his own journey in getting off of opioids. And his suggestion is that physicians need to be educated not just in how to prescribe these things effectively, but also how to plan to get someone off of them.
I think your point's well taken. I think you limit them to the patients that really need them for a circumscribed time, that's perfectly fine. But again, if you start with a threefold difference in prescribing practices, that's a problem.
No doubt one that will be addressed. Finally, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a problem that many people find really troubling to deal with. That's hair loss when they have to undergo chemotherapy for cancer treatment. In this case, cooling the scalp actually helps reduce that hair loss in women who are undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer.
When I think about chemotherapy, and I think about the side effects that I consider most troubling, is things like nausea and vomiting. But in women that have breast cancer, 50% considered hair loss the most traumatic aspect of getting chemotherapy. And about 1 in 12 women reported that they declined chemotherapy because of this particular concern. Scalp cooling suggested it might be beneficial. And that is, if you put a cap on before chemotherapy is started, cool the head down, it restricts blood flow, so when the patient receives chemotherapy, there is less chemotherapy delivered to the hair follicles. And then after the chemotherapy is administered, you continue to cool the scalp for another hour, hour and a half. So in two different studies, looking at two different chemotherapeutic regimens, what the investigators found out was for the women who had their scalp cooled, 50 to 60% of them had an acceptable amount of hair loss. They lost less than 50% of their hair. Are there any side effects? Oh, 2 or 3% complain of having a cool head. So I think this is a good news story. Now you say, well, this is just cosmetic. Well, I'd say that reconstructive breast surgery is cosmetic as well. But we think that's an important part of a woman's therapy. And so it's mandated by many health insurance carriers now. I think it's something we need to offer to women who may receive chemotherapy for breast cancer.
I'm just wondering if while this scalp cooling is going on, did they also offer the patients heated blankets and so forth to keep the rest of their body warm? Because, gosh, that's something that I think if my head was being cooled, I would feel really cold.
They didn't mention that, but they did mention that it was bothers them enough that women stopped it in a very small percentage of cases.
Excellent. I'm going to ask you to determine which of these I should discuss this week on the blog.
I think the scalp cooling was really cool, and I'd like to report that. Is that okay with you, Elizabeth?
Works for me. Bad pun, of course, but certainly I'll be delighted to do that. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.